You're listening to Campaign 2012, a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome to the Campaign 2012 podcast. This is the first in a series of podcasts in connection with the Brookings Campaign 2012 paper series. My guest is Michael Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies, who, along with Bruce Riedel, also a Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies, has written a paper on the AFPAC region and policy in the 2012 campaign in connection with both Afghanistan and Pakistan. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure, Ben. Nice to be with you.
So let's start by talking about the Obama administration's record in this region. It was a big issue in the last campaign. It was something that the president, as a candidate, held out as something he wanted to pursue. How has he done?
You know, it's been frustrating overall, and I'm not sure that's primarily an indictment of the president. I think it's mostly a reflection of the difficulty of the problem, or the problems, because Afghanistan and Pakistan, while linked, each pose their own challenges. I think overall, the president decided he's going to pump a lot of resources at these problems. So we all know what he did militarily. He tripled forces in Afghanistan. He's begun to scale back, but even with the planned reductions, we're still going to have twice as many forces in Afghanistan as he asked the voters for re-election, as we had when he inherited the Oval Office. So that's quite a commitment. With Pakistan, of course, he created this special representative for Afghanistan-Pakistan, the late Richard Holbrooke. He pumped a lot of resources there in terms of economic and military aid, really tried to work the relationships. Hillary Clinton and Secretary Gates and Panetta, the CIA directors, have spent a lot of time there as well. But the bottom line is it's been frustrating. I think there's been progress in Afghanistan. The army's better than it was. The insurgency is weaker than it was a year ago. Maybe not weaker than it was when Obama inherited the White House, though. And therefore, on balance, that combined with the ongoing corruption and political problems in Kabul with President Karzai and others have made this, on balance, I think, less successful than people had hoped, less successful than I had hoped or even predicted. And I think, you know, Bruce Riedel, my co-author, who conducted the policy review for Obama in the first 2 months, I should let him speak for himself, but our chapter reflects a recognition by both of us that things haven't gone quite as well on building up an Afghan state that can control its own territory and prevent the Taliban from coming back and offering sanctuary to terrorist groups. On the other hand, the terrorist groups themselves, and specifically al-Qaeda, are weaker. And Obama's had a lot of success, ironically, in killing bad guys. You know, the president who promised a great vision of a more, you know, sort of harmonic world, a more harmonious world, better relations with the West and Islam, trying to tackle problems of global poverty and climate change and nuclear nonproliferation. One of his great successes has been killing al-Qaeda leaders. And of course, that begins with Osama bin Laden, also includes Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen. But along the whole Pakistan-Afghanistan border, he's killed a bunch, mostly with American drones, a technology and a concept that President Bush had initiated, but that Obama has put on steroids. So that piece has gone well. The last piece, as I mentioned before, is working with Pakistan to deal with their own problems. The good news there is at least Pakistan's not at risk of being overtaken by its own insurgency, the Pakistani Taliban. They've made some progress against it. The bad news is our relationship with Pakistan is worse than it was when Obama took office, and I think worse than any time since 9/11.
Now, you say it's not an indictment of the president, but the president's always accountable. How much of the deterioration and the lack of improvement do you attribute to failed policy, and how much do you attribute to ineluctable forces that maybe policy has been effective at stemming to some degree, but that have a life of their own that are really beyond this or any other president's control?
Yeah, thanks for the follow-up, because I think it's a more mixed and complex picture that I initially perhaps suggested. I wanted to underscore the frustrations are not principally Obama's fault, but there have been issues that have contributed where the administration could have done a better job. And I think the most visible, the most salient, is on Afghanistan policy and how we've dealt with President Karzai. We had a lot of people involved in the diplomacy with Karzai, and half of them wound up in public feuds with him. Now, that's at one level understandable. Karzai's had a lot of weaknesses and failings as a leader, and the corruption problem's been endemic, and it's been a threat to the mission. On the other hand, you don't make it better by getting into these public spats. Karzai tends to turn within, get defensive, tends to blame us for the corruption, where he's half right, because we have created a system of pumping in money and resources that's fueled the problem. And he just gets a little offended. And we've had this problem with Ambassador Holbrooke when he was alive, with Ambassador Eikenberry, who was our ambassador to Afghanistan, also a great American, a person I admire very much. But once he had difficulties with Karzai, whoever's fault it was, we probably needed to move him out of the ambassadorial position. And yet President Obama decided to stick fast with that, partly because he was firing General McChrystal at the same moment when he probably should have been actually replacing Eikenberry. Whatever you think of whether McChrystal's staff's problems and mistakes required his replacement, nonetheless, McChrystal had a very good relationship with Karzai. Eikenberry did not, and yet we kept the people who had the bad relationships, we replaced the people who had the good relationships, and we sent mixed messages to some extent about whether we really wanted Karzai to succeed or just sort of get out of the way, get ready to step down in 2014 as he's required to do. So there were a lot of mixed messages and public spats which did not make him trust us and therefore did not lead him to take the kind of actions we needed him to take. It was mostly the failing of Karzai and his political system, but we contributed.
And what about on the Pakistan side? I mean, there's no doubt, I think, in anybody's mind that relationships between the United States and Pakistan are worse than they were when Obama took office. How much of that is the result of the virtues of the policies that Obama has had vis-a-vis aggressively chasing the enemy into Pakistan? And how much of it is a result of things that he should have done differently or could have done differently?
It's a tough one. You know, I don't have as easy of a time critiquing Obama on Pakistan policy as I do on Afghanistan. On Afghanistan, they really failed to paint a real coherent message, a coherent image of teamwork. Also, Obama, every time he announced an increase in the effort in Afghanistan, was also announcing when it would end, which seemed to be a hedging strategy that made people in the region doubt our commitment. And that may have contributed to why the Pakistanis also never fully got on board with our Afghanistan strategy, because they didn't really believe that Obama was committed. And if we were going to leave Afghanistan in a failed state, they wanted to make sure their proxies, their friends, the Taliban and the Haqqani network, would have some influence. So they kept that kind of group on a life support, or even actively aided, abetted, and protected them. And that led to a lot of deaths of American soldiers, frankly. That's the one thing Obama got wrong towards Pakistan, I think, that you can really identify. Otherwise, I have to say, I think more of the problem here was the Pakistanis. And I realize I'm an American, and it's going to sound like I'm, you know, defending my own country, but I hope I've just established some credibility that on Afghanistan, I think we've been half the problem. On Pakistan, part of what's going on here is the Pakistanis want to dominate Afghanistan. And they claim that it's because they're afraid of India having too much influence and they're afraid of the state failing and they've got to have these contingency plans. But part of it is just good old-fashioned bullying of a country of 180 million vis-a-vis a smaller neighbor of 30 million. And I think the Pakistanis have just decided they want to have disproportionate influence inside their neighbor state. This is not unusual in the way greater powers handle their neighbors through history, and we've been guilty of it ourselves at times in our own past vis-a-vis our neighbors, but it's very unfortunate. And it makes you wonder, are Pakistanis in the military and the intelligence services really correctly sizing up their own best interest? Because if they feel that $3 to $5 billion a year in economic and military aid, plus gradually improving trade relations, plus our sort of helping them diplomatically in squabbles with India, if these things are valuable to them, as I think they should be, why do they want to jeopardize them by at times treating us as the enemy and essentially having American blood on their hands in the form of what they're doing to support these insurgent groups? Now, they will blame us for having Pakistani blood on our hands, as with the November tragedy where we inadvertently killed 24 of their soldiers near an Afghan border patrol base. And it's true, both sides can point to plenty of mistakes the other side has made at their expense. But Pakistanis, I believe, are not thinking strategically enough about the opportunity they have to forge a strong relationship with the United States. And if they're counting on China being, you know, a sufficient friend in the international arena, and they can meanwhile pick fights with the U.S., India, Russia, and anybody else, I think that's a fairly short-sighted way to size up their own interests. The value of dominating Afghanistan should not be high enough in their book to justify this sort of behavior, which is why in our paper, and especially with Bruce Rydell's suggestion, we have suggested a change in strategy towards Pakistan, not walking away from it, but trying to direct more aid towards the civilian government and less towards the military.
So in the campaign, as you note in your paper, this is actually, given the magnitude of the U.S. troop commitment and the stakes, it has actually played a remarkably small role. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about why policy in this region has played such a small role in the election and why the Republican critique, given that there are actually policy failures to talk about, is so muted.
Well, the short answer is no one has a better idea. And we sort of tried everything. We tried not doing very much, then we tried doing a lot. We tried the light footprint strategy in Afghanistan, which was the early Bush strategy. Then we tried gradually beefing it up militarily. Now Obama's losing a little bit of faith in his own strategy and seemingly reducing the military commitment to Afghanistan more quickly than previously planned. And we know General Petraeus was uncomfortable with the accelerated drawdown that was announced in June of 2011. That will bring us to 68,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan at the end of September 2012. But it's not as if Obama has repudiated entirely his strategy. So he creates only a sliver of an opening to be critiqued by the Republicans. Are the Republicans really so confident that they want to call for an indefinite American military presence in Afghanistan when we all know that counterinsurgencies can't succeed if you have a poor partner in the form of Karzai or whoever his successor may be? I'm not trying to suggest we should pull out entirely. But Obama's decision to accelerate the drawdown a bit is not surprising in light of the challenges that we've faced. And I think there's only so much of an opportunity politically for Governor Romney or anyone else to move in and attack from the classic Republican position, sort of to the right of the Democrat on national security. On Pakistan, you know, you could try to make a case for a big new initiative. You could say to the Pakistanis, we will do a free trade accord with you if you can help us really go after the Haqqani network. And you could propose that. The problem is it's a hypothetical. It may be a good idea, but it's sort of hard to win a lot of votes with that kind of suggestion. And it's not as if Romney or even Gingrich or Paul or Santorum is experienced enough in this part of the world to really be able to say, you know, I'm pretty sure such an idea would fly.
But in the last election, I mean, partly as a way of counterpoising Afghanistan against Iraq, Obama as a candidate really decided to make an issue out of Afghanistan, as in you focused on the wrong war, there was the good war over here. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that at this point there is not an essentially partisan critique to be made. Is that right?
Sort of, but I also think it's just 4 years later and we've tried one more strategy and it hasn't been a brilliant success. Uh-huh. Obama, you know, for Obama in 07, 08, all the stars sort of aligned in the same set of directions. He needed to prove he wasn't just a sort of McGovern Democrat, to be a little flip, and with apologies to George McGovern, but nonetheless, who was seen as too weak on defense in the election against Nixon, or even Dukakis, for example. And so Obama needed to learn from those mistakes. So to some extent, he wanted to sound very tough vis-a-vis al-Qaeda and vis-a-vis the Afghanistan war to make sure people did not interpret or misinterpret his opposition to the Iraq war as tantamount to being a lefty president. And so also at that moment in time, the Bush administration really had under-resourced Afghanistan, and almost everyone agreed or now agrees that those first 5, 6, 7 years were a missed opportunity. Whether we had to put 100,000 forces in Afghanistan at that point or not, we did need to at least build up an Afghan army, an Afghan police. We didn't. We minimized our commitment, and so Obama's critique sounded plausible. And it had people like Bruce Rydell in full agreement, and increasingly myself as well, and a lot of other people. But now we're 4 years later. We tried the muscular approach. It produced mediocre results. Let's call it a gentleman's C at best in terms of where Afghanistan and Pakistan are today relative to where we had hoped. And it's not all Obama's fault, but it's not a great success in policy. So what does that leave you? You know, and he has killed a lot of al-Qaeda leaders with drones and commandos. So bottom line, how do you attack him on that front? You're probably better off looking for a different set of issues. And for the Republicans, they've got the economy.
Right. And so you're describing a campaign in which this is a dominant foreign policy issue in governance, but not in campaigning, in which policy has failed and needs to be recalibrated, and in which the essential dynamics of the discussion are not especially partisan. So where does that leave a new administration coming in, whether it's a new Obama administration or a Mitt Romney administration or a Newt Gingrich administration? What needs to happen starting next January in order to recalibrate this policy in a way that will be more effective than it has been over the last few years?
Well, just to tick off a couple of things, and we try to get them in more detail in the paper. One big decision for the newly elected president, whoever he may be, is how fast do we draw down from the 68,000 troops that we're going to have by this fall? Now, President Obama may have by then decided to continue the drawdown. So by Election Day, we may be below 68,000. But if we stay there temporarily, the new president or newly elected president is going to have to make a decision. And presumably another policy review will be appropriate, a couple of 3 months long, at which point I think we'll be into the 2013 fighting season. In Afghanistan, there's a lot more violence in the warm months because the insurgents often essentially camp out and therefore fight a lot more diligently during the warmer months than in the cold. And so by the time a policy review is completed, the natural thing would be to say, maybe let's keep forces through September 2013 and then draw down from there. That would be one big set of questions, though. Do you do something like that? Also, in 2014, we're supposed to hand off complete nationwide responsibility for security to the Afghan army and police. In fact, we might accelerate it. Secretary Panetta was recently encouraging thinking along those lines in a trip to NATO. And so the question remains, what's the U.S. role after that transfer? Do we keep 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 forces to help do these special operations and drone strikes and help with intelligence and training? Or do we do what we did in Iraq and just leave? And or is there something in between? So that's a big set of issues. Then you've got to think about, okay, Karzai is supposed to step down in 2014. How are we going to help the Afghans make that transition, including how are we going to pressure Karzai to keep to his word and not what you might say is a sort of pulling a Putin, figuring out some way to stay in power even when he's constitutionally required to step down? That's a big set of issues. And finding the right set of incentives to Karzai and to other political actors in Afghanistan is going to be a big part of the agenda. And I think, you know, with Karzai, one of the questions is, can we find a way to help create a UN position on relations between Islam and the West, some other thing that would be up to the dignity and the charisma that I think he really does possess and is capable of wielding in certain ways in that kind of a job, perhaps quite well, but to make sure he steps down from his current job, where Afghan democracy requires a transition. And then on Pakistan, I already mentioned shifting aid from the military towards the civilian sector, the civilian government is an important area. But we also, ironically, might want to think big. Most people are sick of working with Pakistan, but it may be the moment when you counterintuitively say to the Pakistanis, we can offer more, a free trade agreement, a big energy sector initiative, if you will do a lot more by way of clamping down verifiably on the Haqqani network and on the Afghan Taliban that uses your territory for sanctuary and headquarters. Proposing that kind of a deal, it might be a long shot, but sometimes, as Eisenhower used to say, when you've got an insoluble problem, enlarge it rather than making it smaller.
Now, with Pakistan, you have a real tough love message, or maybe just tough, no love. You say very clearly that we have to stop thinking of Pakistan as an ally, or at least the Pakistani military as an ally, and we have to see our interest and the Pakistani military's interest as essentially hostile to one another. How does that square with a big initiative that's sort of predicated on we'll do a lot more together? And you know, how realistic is it to think of this country in which we need to operate in some ongoing sense and fly our drones over as an essentially hostile territory with whom we are, I mean, you actually say something like containment, whom we're engaged in something like containment with?
Yeah, you're right that we use that kind of language, but I'm glad that you gave me the chance to explain, because I don't think we can go so far as to treat Pakistan as a hostile state. If we do, we've lost the game in Afghanistan. I mean, if they are actually in a declared way working against us as a matter of comprehensive policy, we're in bad shape. Right now, they sort of work against us a third of the time, work with us a third of the time, and then look the other way a third of the time. And what we have to do with Bruce Rydell's concept that I've, you know, agreed to as part of this paper, but Bruce is really the driving force behind this, is to basically say, you know, those proportions have shifted a little bit in the wrong direction the last couple of years. We've got to recalibrate our policy to try to push them back in the right direction. So it's more nuanced than, let's say, the title in Bruce's New York Times op-ed that got this whole ball rolling back in the fall would suggest. And Bruce basically talked about containment, or the I should say the op-ed page at the New York Times gave him a title that talked about containment and, you know, treating Pakistan virtually as a hostile place. In the paper, I think we're trying to strike a tone that's a bit more nuanced, to say, you know, we still want to give $2-3 billion a year in aid to Pakistan. So that's not exactly how you treat your enemies. But we want to shift that towards more of the civilian and economic sectors, less towards the military. Since money is fungible, Pakistan can always compensate by putting more of their budget into their military and letting us fund things they previously had to pay for themselves. And so it's not as if this puts them in a huge dilemma, but it sends a message that we need to shift our orientation a bit more towards the weak civilian government and tell the military, you know, we can take at least incremental steps that you may not like if you're going to do things that we don't like. And let's rethink this before it goes too much further down this path.
One last question. You talk in the paper about the importance of an institution-based government, not a person-based government in Afghanistan, which is one of the predicate reasons for your strong insistence that Karzai step down at the end of his term. I know some readers will react to that as a reiteration of early 2001-2002 era naivete about what's doable in Afghanistan realistically. And I'm curious for your thoughts on that. What, you know, this is a country that has lacked institution-based government for a very, very long time, and which our prior efforts to build it have not availed much. And I guess I'm interested in why we should have any confidence that this time would or could or will be any different.
Well, we're not looking for super results. You know, we would be happy with incremental progress. In other words, the Afghan parliament has sometimes showed some spine the last couple of years. They've refused a lot of Karzai's initial appointments after he was reelected president in 2009. That was to their credit. A little more of that kind of backbone we should encourage. There might be some small things that they can do in Afghanistan without revising the constitution. For example, right now, the Afghan parliament really has no research arm like we have in the U.S. Congress with the Congressional Research Service, GAO, CBO. Maybe they should create one, and that would allow them to take more of a proactive lead on some key policy issues. There are things like that that can be done that are relatively small ball ideas that at least push in the right direction, because there is one big thing that we do need to accomplish by 2014, which is a successful transition of power. And the problem is, you know, whether I'm naive or not about what's possible in Afghanistan, what I see coming is not pretty. Because what I see coming is a successor to Karzai being chosen in a country where personalities and patronage networks are the only game in the political arena. And therefore, it's a situation where you exacerbate tensions between ethnic groups, where you create clear winners and clear losers. And it's not about a vision for the country. It's about who gets access to the spoils. That's the political system that exists right now. And Karzai, whatever his strengths, and he has some, is presumably going to try to engineer a succession process where he has a lot of role in who's replacing him. And it's going to be based on who's loyal to him, who's loyal to his friends. We just got to try to at least shift that a little bit more towards a debate that involves some ideas. It doesn't have to be dominated by ideas. I'm not unrealistic in that sense. But if the election is about nothing but personality and patronage networks, we have a higher risk of a coup, a civil war, or Karzai inventing a reason to stay on. We just got to try to nudge the needle more towards substantive debate. And some of the ideas can be fairly straightforward. You know, there could be a part of the budget created to directly support some of the regional and provincial governments, for example. Wouldn't have to be a big shift, but it would allow a little bit of decentralization. That's the kind of idea they can debate in Afghanistan. They can debate whether they want us to stay after 2014 and with what size force. It would be good to see some substantive debate on that instead of having it just be what kind of a mood Karzai was in the night before when he negotiated with our representative be the determining, you know, factor in whether or not we get a deal. Just a little bit more substance, a little bit more policy, and a little more distribution of power would be healthy. And the Afghans have pretty good instincts along these lines. So we have some raw material to work with.
Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Ben. Thank you.
For more information about the paper discussed here or the Campaign 2012 project, please visit our website at www.brookings.edu/projects/campaign2012.